Blog Talk Radio.
Imagine there's no America.
Civilization Jihad Awareness, the show where truth wins every time. And I am here stepping in for Cal tonight, who had oral surgery. And as she said in the chat room, she might sound a little funny, but her surgery went well. Thank God for that. Well, let's talk about where the term Civilization Jihad comes from, because I did not create it. We can thank the Muslim Brotherhood of North America for that one. We learned that because In 2004, a Maryland transit officer observed a woman in a burqa taking pictures of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge support structure. The officer watched as she got into a car with a man who was driving, and he pulled them over, and it was Ismael Briss. The woman's husband handed his ID to the officer, who verified the information. Flag came up on El Brace as he was wanted by the FBI for questioning. That provided enough evidence to get a search warrant for his house. Well, Operation Green Quest followed through, and they discovered a hidden sub-basement in his house with 93 banker's boxes of documents from the Muslim Brotherhood of North America. And in there is what we talk about. It's called the Explanatory Memorandum, and it was used in a court of law in 2007. Against the Holy Land Foundation and the Holy Land Foundation trial. Now, I'm just going to read you one small paragraph. It's titled, Understanding the Role of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America. The process of settlement is a civilization jihadist process with all the word means. The Ikhwan must understand that their work of in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers. so that it is eliminated, and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Without this level of understanding, we are not up to this challenge and have not prepared ourselves for jihad yet. It is a Muslim's destiny to perform jihad and work wherever he is and wherever he lands until the final hour comes. And there is no escape from that destiny except for those who choose to slack. But would the slackers and the mujahideen be equal? Now, let's get into the news. Wow. There is, as I say every time I do a show, there is an awful, awful, awful lot of news. And, you know, we say often with this network and anybody who does this kind of work is that Islam is the gift that keeps on giving, and we sometimes wish it would simply stop. So without further ado, I want to start with the one piece that somewhat makes me laugh and surprised me. I like David Wood, and I caught a piece that David Wood had done on Joe. Now, if anyone gets me surprised, it's that Joe Biden actually gets it. I'm sorry. I just, that's a shocker for me. If it's not for you, maybe it should be. I'm still having a hard time with that, that Joe Biden actually figured it out. Now, I'm just trying to make sure I have the piece. I had it up here just a second ago. And where did it go? Going down. Come on. I just had it lined up a second ago. Joe Biden, where are you? And with my luck, things won't show. Here we go.
I think we can all agree that the greatest problem the world faces in the 21st century is the problem of Islamophobia. At least that's what I keep hearing from Muslim organizations. The irrational fear of Islam has been sweeping the globe for nearly 1400 years, ever since the beloved Prophet of Islam, Allah's prayers be upon him, began peacefully slaughtering unbelievers in the name of love. You'd think that in our time, we would have finally learned to be tolerant of Muhammad's calls for the violent subjugation of all humanity. But no. Racists and bigots continue their hate-filled opposition to the Prophet's rulings. Take racist Joe Biden, for instance. When racist Joe Biden heard that the peaceful and benevolent nation of Brunei was about to begin stoning men and women to death for homosexuality and adultery, did he respond with tolerance and respect? Not at all. Racist Joe Biden responded with what can only be described as hate speech. He tweeted, "Stoning people to death for homosexuality or adultery is appalling and immoral. Every single person on earth is entitled to be treated with dignity and to live without fear. There is no excuse, not culture, not tradition, for this kind of hate and inhumanity." President Obama would spin in his bicycle helmet if he saw this tweet. Racist Joe Biden calls Brunei's implementation of Islamic law appalling, immoral, hateful, and inhumane. This sort of criticism of Islam is precisely what led a white supremacist to open fire at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. At least, I keep hearing from of Islam is what led to the white supremacist attack on immigrants. Did the Sultan of Brunei invent Sharia? No. Sharia is based on the commands and practices of Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him. Sunan ibn Majah, 2555. It was narrated from Imran bin Hussein that a woman came to the Prophet and confessed to committing fornication. This woman was married, so it was adultery. He issued orders, and her garments were tightened around her so that her private parts would not become uncovered. Then he stoned her, and he offered the funeral prayer for her. Sunan ibn Majah, 2561. It was narrated from Ibn Abbas that the Messenger of Allah said, "Whoever you find doing the action of the people of Lut, kill the one who does it and the one to whom it is done." Lut is Lot. The action of the people of Lot refers to homosexual sex between two men. Muhammad tells his followers to kill the one who does it and the one to whom it is done. So both partners in the homosexual relationship. Is a Muslim ruler free to dismiss the decisions of Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him? Absolutely not. As we read in the Holy Quran, Surah 4, verse 65, but know by your Lord, they can have no faith until they make you, O Muhammad, judge in all disputes between them and find in themselves no resistance against your decisions and accept them with full submission. Allah Almighty declares in the Holy Quran that a Muslim can have no real faith until he makes Muhammad judge in all disputes, finds in himself no resistance against Muhammad's decisions, and accepts them with full submission. What did Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him, say was the punishment for homosexuality and adultery? Death. Is the Sultan of Brunei, as a Muslim ruler, supposed to ignore the decisions of his prophet or submit to them? Islam, which means submission, requires him to submit to the decisions of Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him. And how does racist Joe Biden react? Does he praise the Sultan of Brunei for doing exactly what Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him, ordered him to do? No. He sends a tweet to more than 3 million followers calling Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him, appalling, immoral, hateful, and inhumane. Joe Biden? More like Joe Bigot. Friends, we have a decision to make. Either we have to continue claiming that any criticism of Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him, and his teachings is the product of racism, bigotry, and Islamophobia, in which case racist Joe Bigot is a racist, a bigot, and an Islamophobe for calling Sharia penalties appalling, immoral, hateful, and inhumane, or we can all agree that it's perfectly acceptable to criticize and condemn the life and message of Muhammad, Allah's prayers be upon him. But what kind of world would we live in if we treated Islam like other ideologies and didn't give it the privileged status it demands? You have 24 hours to decide.
I want you to think about that, that Islam demands a privileged status. It demands to not be questioned. It demands to not go through critical thinking or any critical evaluation. So that is a lot of what happens in society. Here's a story that should – it comes from an academic. Campus Watch, one of the Middle East Forum's outstanding programs, I should say, we have Cinnamon Stillwell. She wrote on March 27th, Wolford College professor Courtney Dural tells Westerners to ignore Islamism and fight Islamophobia. Wait a minute. You remember my guest last, that last guest I had, Lori Hopkins Kavanaugh. She got in trouble for using the term Islamism. She was in Facebook jail for using the term Islamism. So what, were they listening to Professor Courtney Dural saying, oh, well, we can't use that term? Let's think about this. So let me read this article and hold this into your head for a little while and think. So Cinnamon Stillwell writes, in the wake of the mosque shooting in New Zealand, Middle East studies academics have stepped up the hysteria about Islamophobia, despite the fact that such attacks are exceedingly rare and that there is no related mass ideological movement in the West. For example, Courtney Dural, an Islamic studies professor at Wolford College in South Carolina, declared in a lecture this week that we have, this is quote, we have an issue with Islamophobia in the West, unquote. She then announced that my colleagues and I don't think, when she's asking if Muslims are denouncing Islamist terror attacks, which one hardly ever hears these days, is a quote, appropriate conversation. It's not appropriate, huh? Okay. Instead, she concludes, it should be non-Muslims that are fighting Islamophobia because we're the ones that are Islamophobic. Wait a minute. I want you to think about that. In other words, shut up and pay no attention to Islamism because the real problem is Western Islamophobia. isn't the real problem the people who want to change the country into something it isn't? They're wanting to bring Sharia to a country that is not Muslim. They want to bring the devastation that they had over in Somalia here. They want to bring the devastation they have in Syria here. That's what they want. I mean, that's the kind of government they want. What happened in Syria recently? Is that the kind of place you want to live? And the answer is absolutely not. I think this is hilarious. Don't talk about Islamism. Don't ask Muslims to say, to denounce attacks. That's wrong. And this is from a person calling herself a professor? To me, that stuff is scary. Thank you, Cinnamon Stillwell, for exposing this. My next one, thank you, Canary Mission. Canary Mission is an outstanding organization. If you have extra cash laying around and you can give some, please do to canarymission.org. They found a dentist. Oh my gosh, this is just amazing stuff. Nesrin Zayed is a dentist who has joked about torturing Zionist patients. She has also expressed support for Hamas and anti-Israel terrorism. Zayed endorsed United States Senate candidate Patrick Little, who ran as a Republican in 2018, promoting an anti-Jewish neo-Nazi platform. How he ever got on a Republican ticket with that blows my mind. I mean, think about it. Nazis are fascism. Oh, wait a minute. We're talking about liberalism. Oh, where's that supposed to be in the Democratic Party? Okay. Wow. She has also promoted a petition in 2018 started by Students for Justice in Palestine at the University of California, Berkeley, demonizing pro-Israel students and calling to support SJP founder Hatem Bazian. Zayed is a supporter of the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement and has also promoted anti-Israeli events and activities on Twitter, organized by Al-Awda, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition. As of May 2018, Zayed's Twitter bio said she was a Palestinian dentist, proud Muslim, temporarily in the exile, and located in the United States. Joking about torturing Zionist patients. On September 24, 2015, in response to a tweet that read, this is for you, Nesrin. Was a video. She tweets, I love the video. I'll enjoy torturing her Zionist patients with pleasure. Zayed was responding to a tweet that linked to a scene from a movie, A Little Shop of Horrors, where a dentist played by Steve Martin joyfully inflicted pain on his patients. On December 15, 2016, Zayed tweeted, in solidarity with the people of Aleppo during the 29th anniversary of the Hamas movement in Gaza, Aleppo has fallen. The tweet featured photos of demonstrators holding Hamas flags at the 29th anniversary of the movement's founding. On January 2, 2016, Zayed said, heartbreaking, watch the funeral of the 17 martyrs killed by Israel last month. God give their family strength. The tweet featured photos of the funerals of Hamas terrorists killed while committing terror acts. And on October 30th, Zayed tweeted, we still love Hamas. Again, Hamas is a designated terror organization by the United States. And this woman, again, who says she is from Palestine, professing to support a terror organization. Now, is that grounds for her to be removed as an immigrant? That's a good question. I mean, if she's born here and she's still doing this, and she's the one telling people she's not fully from here, there's a lot of questions that can go into that one. Well, let's get into some more interesting articles. We have from Robert Spencer, March 31st. Ilhan Omar in Vogue, Arabia. To me, the hijab means power, liberation, beauty, and resistance. Robert Spencer writes this. To her, maybe, But what does Ilhan Omar think about Aksa Parvez, whose Muslim father choked her to death with her hijab after she refused to wear it? Or Amina Muse Ali, a Christian woman in Somalia whom Muslims murdered because she wasn't wearing a hijab? Has she shown any concern for the 40 women who were murdered in Iraq in 2007 for not wearing the hijab? Or for Alia Al-Asfar, whose Muslim cousin threatened to kill her and harm her family because she stopped wearing the hijab in Britain? Or for Amir Osman Hamid, who faced whipping in Sudan for refusing to wear the hijab? Or the Egyptian girl, also named Amira, who committed suicide after being brutalized by her family for refusing to wear the hijab? Or for the Muslim and non-Muslim teachers at the Islamic College of South Australia, who were told they had to wear the hijab or be fired? Or for the women in Chechnya, whom police shot with paintballs because they weren't wearing a hijab? Or for the women in Chechnya who were threatened by men with automatic rifles for not wearing a hijab? Or for the elementary schools in Tunisia who were threatened with death for not wearing the hijab? Or for the Syrian schoolgirls who were forbidden to go to school unless they wore hijab? Or for the women in Gaza whom Hamas has forced to wear a hijab? How about this for the women in Iran who protested against the regime even before the recent uprising by daring to take off their hijabs? Or for the women in London whom Muslim thugs threaten to murder if they don't wear a hijab? Or for the anonymous young Muslim women who doffed her hair hijab outside her home and started living a double life in fear of her parents? Or for the 15 girls in Saudi Arabia who were killed when the religious police wouldn't let them leave their burning school building because they had taken off their hijabs in their all-female environment, all for girls? Or for the girl in Italy whose mother shaved her head for not wearing a hijab? Courageous women in Islamic Republic of Iran are taking off their hijabs as a sign of resistance to the oppressive Sharia regime, under which they live, and at least 29 women have been arrested. For far too many women around the world, the hijab is not a symbol of power, liberation, beauty, and resistance, but of their own powerlessness, oppression, dehumanization, and subjugation. Who is standing in solidarity with them? Not Ilhan Omar. This is an outstanding article. If you get a chance, write to Robert Spencer. Go to Jihad Watch and send him a note thanking him. Sometimes people just need to hear that. It's one of the best pieces I think he's written in a while. I love that piece. Now, I was just sent an article, and I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to tell you what the headline is. The reason I won't read it is because it's by an idiot. Juan Cole is an academic idiot. He has, very little brain power. I'll say that. He appears as an academic. So let me read you his bio. Is the founder and chief editor of Informed Comment and Richard P. Mitchell Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's author, among other things, of books like Muhammad, Prophet of Peace. Yeah, he created a Quran of Peace. Is that possible? Yeah, he must have had to leave out an awful lot in the Quran to do that. But here's what the title is of what he wrote. The Ilhan Omar Effect. 50% of Americans now favor a Palestinian state. Excuse me? Who were they surveying? I mean, I don't know where they get these made-up polls from. And usually, if it's something Juan Cole is citing, it's inaccurate or it's a made-up statistic. So I had a friend send me this, and I was just kind of like, that man is an idiot. Why would you even read anything by that brainless peon? And I'll say that about Juan Cole. I'm very disgusted. I don't consider his work even close to academic. It wouldn't stand up to a high school scrutiny. So, you know, if Juan Cole ever wants to debate, I think I'd enjoy that because, you know, you think about that, someone with a master's degree versus someone with a that's about what it would be for any for a high school student. My high school students could debate Juan Cole and win. That's just about where he's at. It's unfortunately truthful. Unfortunate. Now, going on. Investigative Project on Terrorism has another outstanding article out there. Fear of isolation and collapse driving Hamas's violent extortion racket. This came out March 29th. When it seized power in a 2007 violent coup, Hamas thought it would turn the Gaza Strip into a shining example of Palestinians' Muslim Brotherhood rule and a spearhead of the jihadist long-term war on Israel. Fast forward 12 years, and Hamas's de facto state is facing economic collapse, a breakdown of its infrastructure, regional isolation, and a population that is increasingly fearless about expressing its anger at Hamas over the hopeless situation it is in. In its 12 years as the sovereign regime of Gaza, Hamas has tried to dance at two weddings, staying true to its terrorist DNA on the one hand, while trying to act like a, quote, legitimate government on the other, in charge of law and order and basic services. This identity crisis has helped drive Gaza to the edge of an abyss, and Hamas is now desperately looking for something or someone to provide relief. Hamas prioritized its military wing above all else, and Gaza's civilians have been left with very little. Today, Hamas is isolated, facing pressure from Egypt, the Palestinian Authority, and Israel. And the more that it feels like it's in the corner, the more it is prepared to take risky steps to try and find a way out of its distress. During the past year, Hamas felt that Gaza's economic situation was increasingly approaching implosion. To avoid this crisis point, Hamas employed a policy of controlled escalation to pressure Israel, Egypt, and the international community to find a solution, namely international donors and an opening of border crossings. In essence, Hamas has been engaged for the past year in a mass extortion scheme, which continues to this day, and which could soon come to a head. Hamas refuses to stop mass-producing rockets and pointing them at Israeli cities, and refuses to stop trying to orchestrate mass casualty terror cells in the West Bank. At the same time, it demands free access to the outside world and claims security restrictions against it are part of the unjust siege against it that must be lifted. Hey, you're trying to kill my people, and I can stop you with a wall or something. I'm containing you. I consider it incredibly intelligent on Israel's part, protecting their people. Oh, wait a minute. Is that something the Democrats are afraid to do in this country? They won't put a wall up to protect their own people? You have to wonder, what's the purpose of a politician who refuses to protect their own people? At least in Israel, they understand that. Hamas can't understand because you know what? They're the ones doing the attacking. They're the ones doing the harm. And they brag about it when it's done. Because what do? They run outside and share candy with each other when they attack and kill Israelis. Group. This next story should have several people upset. I want you to think of the freedoms you have in Canada and in the United States in regards to freedom of speech. Those freedoms that still exist in some Western countries in Europe are getting less and less. This story makes me angry, and I'll do my best to read it without losing it. It comes from Breitbart. 91-year-old Swede convicted for anti-Islam hate speech online. This comes from Chris Tomlinson. In the original article, I was not able to get because it's a lot of this is behind a paid wall. So I'm using Breitbart's translation. A 91-year-old Swedish man has been convicted of hate speech in the municipality of Bromölla after making disparaging comments about Islam and Muslims online. The man, who may be one of the oldest Swedes on record to be convicted of hate speech, posted a number of comments in a Facebook group containing around 12,000 people, in which he disparaged Muslims, according to a Swedish news source. Among the posts written included one in which the elderly man said, referring to Muslims, "You cannot, with the best will in the world, call these beings people. They seem to be inbred as they carry on." For Kristianstad District Court, convicted the man of hatred against an identifiable ethnic group. Noting that the post reached a potential audience of 12,000 and had been up for nearly a year. Ooh, wow. It was up for a whole year. So his speech was okay for 12 months? The messages have content. That is, quote, this is what they said, the court said. This is a quote. "The messages have content that is clearly abusive to Muslims and is therefore expressed with such inaccuracy as is required to be held liable for the crimes against ethnic." While the normal penalty for the crime would include 2 months in prison, the 91-year-old was given a conditional sentence along with he has to pay basically £535 or 6,500 Swedish kroners, which is basically $700 in our money here. This case is just the latest to involve a Swedish pensioner convicted for hate speech made online. In 2017, a man in his 70s was convicted for a similar post in which he referred to Muslims as monkeys on Facebook. Earlier this year, another pensioner, this time in Uddevalla, was convicted and fined 7,200 kroner, which is basically $775, for a Facebook post in which the 70-year-old claimed that Somali migrants were lazy and refused to work. In the last several years, Sweden has been a surge in reported of hate speech crimes. Hate speech crimes. So I don't think speech should be hateful. I think you should temper what you say. I don't think you should be making statements that you can't prove, and that's a scary thing. However, I do think you should be able to say what you want. I'm not saying you should be able to lie like a rug, like Juan Cole does quite well, but I am saying you need to do your best to say what's truthful and right. But stopping anybody from saying what is true, what they want, just because you think it's oppressive or it might hurt your feelings. Dang, that stops too much in speech. It stops too much. Too much. That's the scary, scary truth of it. Going on, we have. I want to play one more piece, one more audio piece for you. It comes from Jada Fransson. Now, Jada Fransson has quite the story, and I really think it's important to listen to. This is almost 10 minutes long, but again, this is an outstanding piece.
My name is Jada Fransson, and I am a British political activist. I'm making this video to share my story with you, to let you know what I've been subjected to over the past year. Last year in March 2018, I was sentenced to 9 months in prison for exposing a gang of rapists. At the end of my sentence in November 2018, I was told that I was being placed on PSS, which is post-sentence supervision. It's an order that has 6 standard conditions, one of which is that you must live at an address approved by your probation officer. I told my probation officer before my sentence finished that I was going home to my house in Northern Ireland, and she said that I wasn't allowed to. At the end of my sentence, she told me that I could only live in a hotel in England that I had to pay for, wasn't allowed to moved back to my house in Northern Ireland, had to still pay the mortgage on the house and leave it empty, but had to live in a hotel in England, one address that she had approved. Of course, who can afford to do that? Who can afford to shut their front door and say, I'm going to pay the mortgage for the next 8 months, but I'm also going to book myself into a hotel for 8 months every day? It's not practical. So I flew home. I came to Northern Ireland and she issued an arrest warrant for me, and police raided houses in London looking for me, despite the fact that they knew I was here. Then I got on a plane and flew to England to spend Christmas with my godchildren. I was arrested on that plane by armed police, taken to a police cell, held overnight, taken to court, and then they bailed me. This is the irony of the situation. They bailed me to my house in Northern Ireland. So then I stood trial on the 6th of February back in England. And at that trial, my probation officer provided the court with a breach report. Now, in that breach report, it expressly states that the Probation Board of Northern Ireland were the ones that made the decision that I could not live in my home in Northern Ireland. My probation officer has confirmed this to me in an email prior to that trial on five separate occasions. I've got five emails from her stating it was the probation service in Northern Ireland that said I'm banned from living in my home address. She also took the stand at my trial and said the same thing to the magistrates. So they convicted me of breaching my PSS. And they sentenced me not to jail. They could have sent me to jail for a week. They could have given me a fine. They sentenced me to community service because she suggested that I get community service. And you know why? Because it has to be served in England. I stood in the dock and I said, I cannot serve community service in England. I am homeless if you keep me in England. My home is in Northern Ireland. I've got nowhere to live in England. They simply said she has to find somewhere immediately. She has to live in England and can't leave. Imagine that. Imagine if you live in England and you came to Northern Ireland for a weekend, got in trouble, got arrested, and then the court in Northern Ireland said, that's it, you can't go back to England. You have to find somewhere to live here now. Who can do that? It's not realistic. So after this passed, something really interesting happened. My probation officer's line manager sent my solicitor an email. And in that email, she stated that it wasn't the probation service in Northern Ireland that made that decision that I couldn't come home. It was them. It was my probation officer. She made the decision. So she lied. She lied in those five emails. She lied in that breach report, and she lied under oath on the stand at my trial, and she did so to get me convicted, and it worked. That's perjury. That's a criminal offence. If you or I took the stand and lied and got someone wrongfully convicted, we would be in jail. As either perjury, contempt of court, or perverting the course of justice, all of which carry really hefty prison sentences, and I can assure you, if I did that to someone, I'd be in jail. These people think they're above the law. So I've had to report this to the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission to ask them to help me with my human rights to a private life, to stay in my home. I've even contacted my local MP, who's Lady Sylvia Herman. This is a very respected politician, a very respected member of parliament, and I am one of her constituents. So she put my case forward to the Ministry of Justice. Do you know what they did? They ignored her. Just like I'm being ignored. I've been ignored by my probation officer for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. But they're actually ignoring a democratically elected member of parliament, a respected politician. That's a step too far, surely. I've even had to report my probation officer to the police because it's a crime. And so I've appealed this decision. My appeal is being heard at Croydon Crown Court on the 17th of April. At that stage, I'm going to have to stand up in court and say, my probation officer lied to you last time. That's a criminal offence. But see how sneaky the probation service are in England. Knowing that my appeal is on the 17th of April, they've summoned me back to court on the 1st of April for six further charges of breach. Now, each of those charges now carry 2 weeks in jail. So you see how they're really racking up jail time against me. This is all deliberate. And this is all going on at a time when, as if this isn't bad enough, I'm also being sued for £500,000 by the Halal Food Authority. I have had my passport confiscated by SO15 counter-terror police and told that I'm banned from leaving the country. I can't leave the UK. I can't go to England to visit my friends and family because there are warrants out for my arrest. And I've just stood two trials in Northern Ireland. I have to go back to court on Friday the 29th of March for judgment, and I could be going back to jail for a year for hate speech. Now, this hate speech is because I gave a speech at an anti-terror rally against terrorism, but I could go back to jail for a year. There are distress warrants out for me in England claiming that my assets are going to be seized, because when I got out of jail last year, I left with a colossal amount of debt because I hadn't been paid and I had huge debts weighing down on me. And just to top it all off, I've started a new venture of my own, jadafranson.online. My payment system lasted less than 24 hours and was pulled down. So things are pretty doom and gloom at the moment, aren't they? But here's the good news. The good news is I smile and I laugh every day. And every day I wake up and I'm grateful for what I've got. And every day I know that God has brought me this far and he will not forsake me. And I know that wholeheartedly. And for that reason alone, I won't be giving up. I won't be giving up on God. I won't be giving up on myself. I won't be giving up on this cause. And I won't be giving up on any of you. So please don't give up on me. With all the deplatforming and social media restrictions, you know, this is a plan by the state so that I can't be in touch with you. I can't share my story with you. I can't tell you what the state are doing to me. They are trying to completely silence me, to wipe me out, to remove me from the public domain, to remove me from people's memory. And, you know, if it weren't for the likes of you and your continued support, they'd win. But here's what I'm asking of you. Please share this video, share my story, let people know what the British establishment are doing to me. It's corrupt and it's wrong, it's evil on every level. And so if my immediate fate, as I suspect it is, includes jail time and further persecution, then so be it. I can face anything the state throws at me if I know that I've got the loyalty and the backing and the continued support of the people that I do this for, you, the people watching this video. So please keep this going. Please don't let the state win. Don't let me be forgotten. Don't let me be cast into the darkness, which is what they want. If I can depend on you to do that for me, then you can depend on me forevermore to stay true to this cause. I give you my word on that. Thank you for watching my story. Please share it as much as you can. God bless.
And that is Jada Franson. The video on YouTube is behind a restricted banner. You have to sign into YouTube in order to see this. Was there anything offensive in here? And the answer is no. So they're restricting her, what? Her freedom of speech? She didn't say anything offensive. She wasn't offensive to anybody. There's absolutely nothing besides current events of her life in this. And if that's offensive to the British people, what are they afraid that a probation officer, that someone's going to testify against a probation officer? Is that why they put it behind a restricted wall? I have some serious questions about Britain and their forgetting the importance of speech and the rights of, but again, that's why America had to kick their ass basically and get them out of here. Because they didn't respect the common man. And now the only respect they're giving is to their new masters. It's frustrating to think that this is happening today. But again, when I heard this and I saw this yesterday, I thought there was something, if I wasn't going to, Kel had, this is just the perfect timing, because Kel had asked, and I just seen this video like 5 minutes before she asked if I could help out, and I figured this was important to be shared with today. So if you want the audio, I will even just send you the audio if you would like. Go to the YouTube. Let me. I don't know if I can find that YouTube right now. Type in Jada Franson. It's, again, the problem with sharing this is if people do not have, do not log into Google or whatever, they can't view this. So I'll give you my email real quick if you want the audio copy. And it's BEREAN_research@yahoo.com. Ask me for the Jada Franson audio, and I will send it to you free. There we go. Going on. Good news. Well, let's see. I am back at work, and I have been now. I just started my third week back. I just finished my physical therapy for the week. I did that just before I got home to do the show. And I'm doing okay. My knee is doing better. I'm learning different things about what's painful, what isn't. For those who don't know, on December 20th of this year, I tried stopping a fight at the school where I work. I tried stopping a fight. As a result, I cried out in pain and enough to make teachers open their doors into the hallway, which is where we were. And the kids stopped fighting because they saw the teacher crying in pain. I have a torn ACL and a torn meniscus. And I'm using a cane, getting around fine. I'm walking 3 to 4 miles a day just to keep going. But that's my good news. Kel's good news is her oral surgery did well, thank God. Hopefully see her back next week. And there is a ton more news out there. Other good news. We have the good news that I can share is one of the news stories that I had Len on my show, and we were talking about the IRS capability of the IRS to actually tackle the universities and force them to follow the law instead of stifling free speech and claiming to and really being propaganda institutions in lying to people. Well, I'm working with a couple people to deal with that, and we're going to see how that goes. I'm kind of excited to see that in the United States we can use the Constitution and the IRS tax code to force universities to follow the law. And we're going to wait and see how that goes. I'm kind of excited. Good luck to you, Kel. I'm glad it's over. That even reading that makes me cringe. She says she'll be back. And called what she had just a minor procedure. More power to you, Kel. That to me is scary stuff. Surgery as a whole scares me, but wow. Going on. Kel did put up in the chat room earlier that a man had Vlad Christian Aramia charged after Montreal priest stabbed during Mass. Now, this is a Reverend Claude Grou, who was released from the hospital after suffering minor injuries. This comes from the Canadian press. This was in the Huffington Post of all places. So I have to question about what would actually be truthful, but we'll read this. 26-year-old man has been charged with attempted murder on stabbing the Catholic priest during morning mass at a Montreal St. Joseph's Oratory on Friday. Vlad Christian Aramea, who appeared in Montreal courtroom via video conference Saturday afternoon, is also charged with assault with a weapon for allegedly attacking the oratory's 77-year-old rector with a knife. So he attacked a 77-year-old man with a knife. Aramea, who wore a blue and white check shirt, did not speak during his brief appearance or other than to confirm he was represented by a legal aid lawyer. The Crown objected to his release and requested he receive psychosocial evaluation before his bail hearing, which is expected to take place, should have taken place Monday. Crown prosecutors said the evaluation was requested in order to assess the accused's mental state. Earlier Saturday, the priest who was stabbed expressed gratitude for the support he's received from the public. The public are supporting a man who stabs a cleric. Yeah. You kind of wonder what kind of persons would support that. Yeah. Scary, scary stuff. I'm not going to get into much more with this. I just kind of mind numb that somebody would think they're getting public support after stabbing someone. Scary stuff. Next article, UK. And I want to talk about what they're doing, and it just disgusts me. So this is the correct follow-through article. Raymond Ibrahim writes for Gatestone Institute, "Radical Muslims welcome. Persecuted Christians need not apply." Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Raymond Ibrahim. This came out March 31st, again with Gatestone Institute. In two unrelated cases, I've now read three, by the way, two unrelated cases, the United States Kingdom denied asylum to persecuted Christians by bizarrely citing the Bible and Jesus. Both Christians, a man and a woman, are former Muslims who were separately seeking asylum from the Islamic Republic of Iran, the ninth worst, particularly of those who were Muslims and converted to Christianity. UK asylum worker Nathan Stevens recently shared their stories. In his rejection letter from the UK Home Office, which is in charge of immigration, the Iranian man was told that biblical passages were inconsistent with his claim to have converted to Christianity after discovering it was a peaceful faith. The letter cited several biblical excerpts, including those from Exodus, Leviticus, and Matthew, presumably show that the Bible is violent. It said Revelation was filled with imagery of revenge, destruction, death, and violence. Has he actually read the book of Revelation? I doubt it. Because, yeah. The government letter then concluded, "These examples are inconsistent with your claim that you converted to Christianity after discovering it as a peaceful religion as opposed to Islam, which contains violent rage and revenge." In response, Nathan Stevens, the asylum seeker's caseworker, tweeted, "I've seen a lot over the years, but even I was genuinely shocked to read this unbelievably offensive diatribe being used to justify a refusal of asylum." Stevens added, "Whatever your views on faith, how can a government official arbitrarily pick bits out of a holy book and then use them to trash someone's heartfelt reason for coming to a personal decision to follow another faith? There seems no awareness that despite occasional verses of violence in the Bible, its main message in both the Old and New Testaments is to be found in Leviticus 19:18. Love your neighbor as yourself." In rejecting the claim for asylum of this man who converted from Islam to Christianity, presumably compelling his return to Iran, the British government is effectively sentencing him to death. In his second case, an Iranian female asylum seeker was informed in her rejection letter, quote, "You affirmed in your asylum interview record that Jesus is your savior, but then claimed that he would not be able to save you from the Iranian regime. It is therefore considered that you have no conviction in your faith and your belief in Jesus is half-hearted." Recently interviewed on BBC Radio 4, the woman who wishes to remain anonymous said, "When I was in Iran, I converted to Christianity, and the situation changed, and the government was looking for me, and I had to flee from Iran. In my country, if someone converts to Christianity, their punishment is death or execution." Concerning the asylum process, she said that whenever she responded to her home office or interviewer, he was either chuckling or maybe just kind of mocking when he was talking to me. He asked me why Jesus didn't help you from the Iranian regime or Iranian authorities. These two recently exposed cases appear to be symptomatic not only of a breathtaking lack of logic that flies in the face of history. God obviously did not always save those who believed in him, not saved physically, we're talking about, but also what increasing appears to be a venomous home office biased against Christians. For instance, when Sister Bon Madeline, a Christian nun in Iraq, who had fled the Islamic State, applied to the home office to visit her sick sister in Britain, she was denied a visa twice. Another report cites a number of other Christian orderlies who were denied visas, including another nun with a PhD in biblical theology from Oxford, a nun denied for not having a personal bank account, and a Catholic priest denied for not being married. Another case, the Home Office has not only denied entry to three heroic Christian leaders, archbishops, celebrated for their efforts to aid persecuted Christians in Syria and Iraq, who had been invited to attend the consecration of the UK's first Syriac cathedral, an event attended by Prince Charles, but also mockingly told them there was no room at the inn. Even longtime Christian residents are being deported. Earlier this year, Asher Sampson, 41, a Christian man who had been residing in the UK for 15 years and undergoing theological studies, was deported back to Pakistan, where he had earlier been beaten and threatened by Islamic extremists. Such treatment is normative for Christians in Pakistan. The world's fifth worst, Sampson's former UK pastor said. I've received some messages from him. He's very scared. He's fearful for his life. He's in hiding in Pakistan, and his family are terribly worried for him. At the moment, he has no funds to live on. He can't work. The UK is sending people back to these countries where their lives are in danger. By contrast, a report from the Barnabas Fund found that in offering asylum, the UK appears to discriminate in favor of Muslims instead of Christians. Statistics confirm this allegation. Figures obtained by Barnabas Fund under a Freedom of Information request showed that out of 4,850 Syrian refugees accepted for settlement by the Home Office in 2017, only 11 were Christian, representing just 0.2 tenths of all Syrian refugees accepted by the UK. Statistics from earlier years have shown the same disparity. Although Christians accounted for approximately 10% of Syria's pre-war population, the overwhelming majority of Syrians granted asylum by the Home Office were Sunni Muslims. Let's think about this. Were the Sunni Muslims in fear from ISIS? No. Were they in fear of Sharia? No. So what were they in fear of? Were the men in any fear? No. So you accepted these people for asylum based on what? I want you to think about this. They had nothing to fear. They would not be prosecuted. What would they have to do? Probably join ISIS. Well, again, fight ISIS. But they couldn't fight them because it would be against Sharia, right? Oh, but that's what they want. They want Sharia. Isn't that what they're expressing in the UK? This makes no sense, people. Why would they do this in the UK? They're just exhibiting their ignorance, which is sad. Lord David Alton of Liverpool, a life peer in the House of Lords, this is going back to the article, wrote to Home Secretary Sajid Javid, who heads the Home Office. It is widely accepted that Christians, who constituted around 10% of Syria's pre-war population, were specifically targeted by the jihadi rebels and continue to be at risk. At the last year's statistics more than amply demonstrate this racial imbalance between Muslim and Christian refugees taken in is not a statistical blip. It shows a pattern of discrimination that the government, talking about the UK, has a legal duty to take concrete steps to address. Considering that persecuted Christian minorities, including priests and nuns, are denied visas, one might conclude that perhaps the Home Office just has extremely stringent asylum requirements. This notion is quickly dispelled, however, when one sees that the Home Office regularly grants visas and refugee status to extremist Muslims. One has yet to hear about Muslim asylum seekers being denied visas because the Quran is too violent or because they do not have enough faith. Ahmed Hassan, despite having no papers and despite telling the Home Office that he had been trained as an ISIS soldier, was still granted asylum 2 years before he launched a terror attack in London train station that left 30 people injured in September of 2017. The Home Office also allowed a foreign Muslim cleric, Hamza Sadagar, to enter and lecture in London, even though he advocates beheading, burning, or throwing homosexuals from cliffs. In addition, according to the report, British teenagers are being forced to marry abroad and are raped and impregnated while the Home Office turns a blind eye by handing visas out to their mostly Muslim husbands. The case of Asia Bibi, a Christian mother of five who spent the last decade of her life on death row in Pakistan for challenging the authority of Muhammad, is perhaps emblematic of the immigration situation in the UK. After she was finally acquitted last November, Muslims rioted throughout Pakistan. In one march, more than 11,000 Muslims demanded her instant and public hanging. As Pakistanis make up the majority of all Muslims in the UK, Sajid Javid, the head of the Home Office, is himself Pakistani. When they got wind that the UK might offer Asia Bibi asylum, they too rioted. As a result, Prime Minister Theresa May personally blocked Bibi's asylum application. Despite UK playing host to Muslim hijackers, extremists, and rapists, one headline read, the UK, in other words, was openly allowing asylum policy to be dictated by a Pakistani mob. That was reported by The Guardian. Quote, after it was confirmed, it urged the Home Office not to grant Asia Bibi political asylum in the UK. At the same time, the Home Office allowed a Pakistani cleric, Syed Muzaffar Shah Qadri, considered so extreme that he is banned even from his own native Pakistan to come and lecture in UK mosques. Qadri celebrated the slaughter of a politician because he had defended Asia Bibi. In short, local Muslim opinion apparently plays a major role in the UK's immigration policy. Radical Muslims are welcomed with open arms. Christian infidels need not apply. Commenting on the difficulties Christian minority asylum seekers have with the Home Office, Dr. Martin Parsons, the head of research at the Barnabas Fund, remarking that visas were granted in July to two Pakistani Islamic leaders who have called for the killing of Christians accused of blasphemy, summarized the situation. Quote, it's unbelievable that these persecuted Christians who come from the cradle of Christianity are being told there is no room at the inn when the UK is offering a welcome to Islamists who persecute Christians. There is a serious symptomatic problem when Islamist leaders who persecution of Christians are given the green light, telling them that their applications for the UK visas will be looked on favorably, while visas for short pastoral visits to the UK are denied to Christian leaders whose churches are facing genocide. That's an urgent issue the Home Office ministers need to grasp and correct. Thank you, Raymond Ibrahim. This article is powerful and important, and it needed to be said. There is, I'm only going to cover a little bit more, and I'm probably going to call it a night. This next one I saved out, it might make some people laugh, but it's sad. This comes again from Breitbart. Sweden to release first report on migration and crime since 2005 by Chris Tomlinson. This came out today, April 2nd. Wow. I can't believe it's April already. All I know is I just wish it was warmer. Here we go. The Swedish Crime Prevention Council, Brach, has commissioned a study comparing crime rates of native Swedes to migrants. According to the agency, the study was commissioned after a great demand for statistics relating to the relationship between migration and crime. A study will be carried out regarding registered suspicions of crimes among persons with a domestic and foreign background. The study will contain similar issues as in the authority's study from 2005, but its design will make it possible to follow developments over time and also highlight more issues than in the previous study, it said in a press release. A number of crimes are to be examined, including violent crimes and sexual crimes, such as rape and sexual assaults. A new study is needed for decision makers to have access to updated data. The results are planned to be early in 2021. But they also noted that they wanted to pay more attention to asylum homes and measure their vulnerability to criminality in order to examine ways to lower crime in them. Due to the lack of official stats on migrant crime, several Swedish newspapers have attempted to create their own studies last year with two papers, Expressen and Aftonbladet, finding the men of migrant origin were vastly overrepresented in cases of gang rape. Last year, the Swedish broadcaster SVT published findings from its own study on migrant crime shortly before the country's national election. The study looked into cases of rape and attempted rape and found that 58% of all cases with convictions involved foreign background men. When the study looked at violent rapes in which the victim did not know her attacker, the number of migrants rose to more than 8 in 10. These are important statistics, and Europe needs to look at these as a whole when they're looking at migrants. Is there a reason to close the door? Is there a reason to protect yourself? This is one of the reasons why I think we have a good man in as president of the United States, that he has said, you know, we need to protect our people. And one of those things he wants to do to protect the people is to build a wall, which would protect the people. I think we need to be careful who we're letting in. I'm so restrictive. I'm into saying no migration for 5 years. Let's put a moratorium on it as a whole. I don't have a problem with people visiting. You just can't stay is what I would say for 5 years. Let us straighten our problems out here that with migration. Let us solve let's take those 5 years and work on making immigration a smoother process. And let's talk again about the integration and assimilation into a society, because we've given up on forcing that. Under Obama, those terms were changed. Assimilation is no longer discussed. Instead, it is integration where people are – it's interesting. They switched the terminology to the point where if you're a migrant and you come here, everybody's supposed to adjust to you instead of the other way around. And again, that's the terminology that's been changed under Obama. They changed all that terminology. I watched it happen, commented, I've written about it. We need to be careful. And we're over the hour, and I didn't want to go too much farther. And the reason is I have a show Thursday, and I think you'll find it fascinating. I have Patrick Dunleavy Thursday. He was the Inspector General of prisons in New York State. This man is probably one of the top dogs in the country to talk about things like prisons, sentences, and the topic on Thursday. Early parole for terrorists. I want you to think about that. Should we be giving early parole for terrorists? And that's what we'll be talking about Thursday. We have a great number of shows on Global Patriot Radio, and we have some excellent, excellent people in this chat room today. Before I forget, I'm going to name them all: AKCOG, Bigfoot, Doc DLB, Gary Comfer. We have Guest 159, Kel, Annie, Vorpal. Thank you all for listening. Tomorrow we have John, I believe it's Invictus. Come and listen. This man is a genius on foreign policy. Come back Thursday. I will be here, and I'll be talking about early parole for terrorists. I'm not for it, so we'll be giving you the facts, and we'll be talking to an expert. That's one of the leading experts in the United States on this field. And then we'll be going Friday. Come back, the Sharia Crime Stoppers. Saturday, we have Usama Dakdak. It's a late night show. I believe it starts at 10 o'clock. Sunday, we have Erica Kfiristan. Come listen in. This guy had a debate last week. I was just amazed listening in. It was powerful. And then come back Monday, we have Alan Vito, the Vito Esposito Show. Come listen in. They're the real radio men. And then you come back Tuesday, and you'll have the beautiful Kel Fritzy here next week. Thank you all for listening. And I'm going to send us out with one of my favorite tunes. And I know it's Kel's favorite tune. And I just have to get it up here. And this is the problem. Here we go. Courtesy, Red, White, and Blue.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Here Uncle Sam put your name at the top of his list, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down. Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue. Sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world.
Harper is raining